Good. Good evening. One of the many pleasures of doing these little talks before Blue Heron concerts is that Scott Metcalf writes excellent program notes, which makes my life a good deal easier. And so if you have not yet looked at the notes in the program, I hope you will. You will benefit from them. Scott has done a wonderful job of laying out a number of things about the particular pieces and some of the issues that they raise for us in trying to understand a period and a body of music that's very distant from us. It also allows me to waver a bit, not do just that, just talk about the pieces, but talk a little bit about the composer, the period, and I hope to clarify in some ways the type of cultural and even perhaps theological background to this kind of music that we're going to be hearing. Much of it sacred music, music intended for a sacred ritual, but in its very construction based on deeply secular music, to be more precise, love music. Johannes Ockeghem, who is the central figure on this program, is without question one of the leading figures of the late 15th century. He comes of age at a moment when the genre that we now associate so strongly with him, the polyphonic mass, was also coming of age. It's not known exactly when Ockeghem was born. Estimates have ranged from as early as 1400, which seems to me exceedingly unlikely, to after 1425, also exceedingly unlikely. My best guess, based on looking at the rest of his career, is that he was born about 1420. To give you some sense of that, that makes him about a generation younger than the greatest composers of the first half of the century, namely Guillaume du Failly and Binchois, composers who have figured at other times on Blue Heron programs. It makes Ockeghem also about a generation older than the next great generation of Renaissance composers, Josquin des Prez and the rest of them. They're all born around 1450 or so. If we're correct in thinking that Ockeghem was born around 1420, it means he came of age, say, in the early 1440s. Our first spotting of him in documents, for example, is as a singer, not any kind of fancy singer, just a run-of-the-mill church singer, but at one of the great northern cathedrals in Antwerp. In 1443, we spot him for 1 year in documents, and then he vanishes. What can I say? 15th century figures have a disconcerting way of vanishing this way from documents. You've got them, you don't got them. You lose them for 10 years, sometimes more. We're fortunate that Ockeghem will reappear only a few years later, but as we'll see, very far from Antwerp and closer to where he would end up spending the rest of his career. At the time that he took up this position as a singer in Antwerp in 1443, the idea of writing a polyphonic setting of the Mass Ordinary, the movements Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Agnus Dei, the things that we now take for granted when we hear that this being a Mass done by Haydn or a Mass of Mozart or Schubert, this idea, it was established but new. It had probably been the invention largely of the English. Now, those of you who are devotees of 14th century music are saying, hang on, there's a polyphonic mass cycle by the great 14th century composer, Guillaume de Machaut, and this is true. It's a wonderful piece. That we all talk about Machaut's mass only underscores the absolute, almost singularity of that piece in its time. There are a few scattered fragments of mass cycles by anonymous composers at the end of the 14th century. But as an idea that really had legs, an idea that was going to have a future, we have to wait until the early 15th century. And as I say, it seems to be English composers, largely unknown in terms of their names, who concocted this idea that let's have five sections of what is, after all, a multi-section ritual, the Mass, organized in a way that each of these five movements will be based on the same pre-existing melody. The idea might strike us as utterly foreign. You're writing a new piece of music, and the first thing you're going to do is figure out what you're going to base it on that already exists. Let's just say that after the 19th century, we have rather different notions of originality, of novelty, of creativity, in a sense. That these English composers would have chosen, in devising this new kind of musical setting, to think almost first of what are they going to base the music on? What sort of pre-existing music can they use as the basis for it? In doing that, they were simply following a long-standing medieval precedent. If we were to trace it all the way back to the earliest phases of polyphonic music in the Western tradition, we would find that that was the root idea. To take, in this case, a bit of plain chant, sacred chant, do something to it, usually lengthen it considerably by making each of its notes very long in duration, and then weaving polyphony around it. It is, in a sense, the fundamental idea of Western polyphony. And it's one that continues to ramify in a number of ways for centuries. What effect might this have had if you were a church-going person in the early 15th century in England? You show up one day, you're accustomed to hearing services that are done just as plain chant, a kind of heightened declamation, maybe with the odd bit of polyphonic something sprinkled along. And suddenly you come in and they do an introit where they all come in, but then when they sing the Kyrie, you have four singers who suddenly start doing this very elaborate music. And then the very next thing that happens in the Mass, of course, is the Gloria. And they do it again, and you notice that actually the beginning of the music of the Kyrie and the beginning of the music of the Gloria are not exactly the same, but very close to one another. Otherwise, the two movements differ, but it stands out. And then you get a lot of plain chant, and you hear plain chant for this and plain chant for that. And after about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, there's another movement now, the Credo, done in polyphony, and so on. It is this punctuating effect. It's something for us to bear in mind because I buy CDs of this stuff and you stick it in the machine and you turn it on and you hear Kyrie, Gloria, track three is the Credo, Sanctus, Agnus Dei, done. but of course, with the exception of the Kyrie and the Gloria, these movements are not contiguous within the Catholic Mass. They're separated by quite a lot of other things, plain chant, various kinds of stage business, there's lots of things that have to happen. So when we listen to these five movements back to back, it's already something of a distortion of just the basic experience of this. Rather, we should imagine within a long extended ritual the idea of occasional punctuations of elaborate polyphony. I think it might be one of the reasons why they have this habit of starting movements within a mass cycle with similar music. It's almost as a way of signaling to us. Here we are, we're back into polyphony again. As I say, this idea, once it catches hold, has a big future. And where it seems to catch hold on the continent is, as it happens, right around the places that the young Ochagem can be traced, not least Antwerp Cathedral. Some of the earliest examples we have of continental mass cycles seem to come from this region, or they seem to be by composers who, like Ochagem, can be placed squarely in Antwerp in the early 1440s. Now, at this kind of chronological distance, I don't want to sort of act as we could put a little button in the pin in the map and say, this is where it happened. Things are, as you know, rarely that neat, even without 500 years intervening. But we do have a sense that this region of northwestern Europe, not surprisingly an area that had extensive trading contacts with England, was one of the first places where the idea of the polyphonic mass emerges on the continent. And there, Ockeghem and some of his contemporaries begin to explore the possibilities. And indeed, Ockeghem, more than any of his contemporaries, explored it further than any, to ends and to reaches that, frankly, no one would in some respects until we come to a figure like Johann Sebastian Bach centuries later. If you will allow me, I'd like to say a few things about Ockeghem's career, because otherwise he can sound like just a name, and a rather complicated, peculiar name at that. Despite its very Flemish sound, Ockeghem, I'm told is how it's supposed to be pronounced, he was almost certainly Francophone. He was born in a town called Saint-Guilain in what is now southern Belgium. Saint-Guilain, then and now, is a small place. It's rather touching to go there now and see that the central place of the town is called the Place d'Ockeghem. It warms my heart to see that. There aren't many central squares or places in this world that are named after 15th century composers. But in Belgium, you can find such things. It's wonderful. Saint-Guilain is not far from the town of Mons. To give you an idea of how rich this area was in producing composers over a period of, well, more than a century, I can put it in these terms. Ockeghem, born probably about 1420 in this little town, Saint-Guilain, a morning's walk away is the town of Mons, where no less a figure than Orlando de Lassus, Orlando di Lasso, as the Italians knew him, was born more than a century later. That is to say, certainly one of the leading figures of the 15th century and one of the leading figures of the entire European scene of the 16th century were born about 8 miles apart from one another. And indeed, you could hardly swing a cat in this part of Belgium, or what is now Belgium, without hitting either a composer or at least a singing school. And the two things are not unrelated. It had developed in the late 14th, but especially in the early 15th century, that had connected to a lot of large collegiate churches or cathedrals were schools. And one of their principal functions was teaching boys to sing. It was their scholarship to the school was that they had to sing. And if they were good at it, they would be pulled aside at some point and taught how to do something that seems to us utterly implausible. Namely, to improvise polyphony vocally, to make counterpoint, as the Italians would call it, alla mente, in the mind, without the benefit of notation. I know, it seems improbable, but we have so much evidence that they did it that we've got to believe it, and we simply have to try and understand it. It seems to have been something that was widespread. It was a highly cultivated skill, no doubt difficult, but one that is worth remembering because, of course, we only have the written music that came from there. But behind that is all of the music that was improvised by these same people, because we should remember that Ockeghem spent much of his life singing liturgical polyphony. Composers earned their keep in the 15th century by being usually clerics attached, if they were lucky, to a wealthy cathedral or a wealthy collegiate church, or just possibly as a cleric within a large noble household. Composing was, in other words, always going to be something they did in addition to whatever else they were doing. For most of them, what they were doing was singing all the time, and Ockeghem certainly did quite a lot of that. He will go on, though, to have other responsibilities, quite considerable ones, rather remarkable for a musician of the 15th century. And this is where we start to have a few interesting, curious lacunae in Ockeghem's career. He makes his way south into eastern France, and in the late 1440s, he emerges at the Bourbon court in eastern France. Now, how he made it from Antwerp there, we don't know. I have a few ideas, but until I've figured them out more, I won't bore you with them. But he clearly makes his way south. And then soon thereafter, in 1451, he goes to the institution with which he will be connected for the rest of his life, namely the French royal court, where he will serve for more than 45 years, becoming the premier chaplain of the French royal court and ultimately the treasurer of one of the royal abbeys of France. That sounds rather grand. It was, actually. We are so accustomed to hearing of composers in earlier periods, and perhaps still now, sorry to say, but in earlier periods, dying paupers, scraping for a living. Again, it's rather gratifying to think that Ockeghem died quite a wealthy man. Wealthy and powerful. As treasurer of the Royal Abbey of Saint-Martin in the city of Toul in the Loire Valley, Ockeghem was a landholder. He was a landlord, literally. He was someone who collected rents, who had certain judicial powers even within the city. We just don't think of composers doing this, but there it is. It meant that he was a high-profile person within the French royal court, especially for a musician. High enough in profile that occasionally we get spottings of him in reports from ambassadors from, say, Milan, who will say, oh, there's the wonderful singer, very virtuous man, Johannes Ockeghem at the French royal court. They never tell us as much as we would like, but one of the things they tell us is that he had a beautiful bass voice, or as one later poet would call it, a vox aurea, a golden voice. Whether that's connected with the fact that some of Ockeghem's music is scored rather low and was intended for him to sing, I don't know. But there is one little detail that we might bear in mind that is related to that idea. And again, it's easy to lose sight of it, because we think of works of music as being composed with an eye towards wide dissemination. A composer today writing a work for an orchestra might be doing it in response to a direct commission from a particular orchestra, but his or her great hope, of course, is that many other orchestras will play it, and as soon as possible, preferably recording it. By contrast, and this was something a colleague pointed out to me a number of years ago, I was a graduate student, and maybe it won't strike you, but it really struck me. He said, we must remember that all of this music, this Ockeghem and Bunois and Dufay, and all this 15th century music, started out as local music. I rather like the idea. Local music. What he meant by that is there was a corps of singers at the French royal court in the 1450s and 60s and 70s. It changed, obviously, from time to time, but it's surprising how many singers persisted there for a long time. It seems to have been a good gig, and you didn't give it up lightly if you were a singer. That is to say that day in and day out, Johannes Ockeghem, as the first chaplain of the court, would have been working with these same singers. And so as he wrote one mass after another, one work after another, he certainly must have, at some level, had the sounds of those particular singers' voices in his ear. They were not just his colleagues, they were almost part of his musical equipment, if you will. They provided the sound image. Again, one can think of later analogs of composers who worked very closely with certain performers and have said that they had the sound of that particular performer's instrument when they were writing. I think I read Benjamin Britten saying something about Rostropovich when he wrote his cello works. What he heard in his ear was Rostropovich's cello, not just any cello. It's a very good choice, I must say. Now, to turn very briefly, before I run out of time here, to the idea of writing a sacred piece on a love song. One reads any number of interpretations of this phenomenon. A number of them can be grouped under a sort of umbrella view that goes something like this. We, moderns, keep the sacred and the secular quite separate. Scott Metcalfe says something like this in his notes, and he puts it in very concise terms. By contrast, in the late Middle Ages, there was a kind of interpenetration of the sacred and the secular. One did not simply cordon off the sacred aspects of one's social life, daily life, in the way that we might be inclined to do, it is said. There is no way of disproving this being part of the explanation for this phenomenon of sacred music based on love songs. And I must say, they're sometimes very decorous love songs, and sometimes not. Some of them are, well, borderline obscene, frankly, in their original with the texts. So, how does one square this? There is a second kind of body of interpretations that could come under a different umbrella, and it takes a slightly more practical view of the matter. It says, composers by the 15th century had been basing polyphony forever on pre-existing music. Now, it's true, in earlier centuries it tended to be basing it on a plain chant or possibly some secular piece, but we shouldn't be surprised that a 15th century composer, particularly those developing a kind of new genre like the polyphonic mass cycle, would have thought first and foremost to base it on pre-existing music. Ah, the rejoinder is, yes, but some of them based them on sacred plain chants, others on bawdy love songs. Is there no difference between the two? To which this more practical response is, no, there isn't. That is to say, in each case, what the pre-existing piece provides the composer is a starting point, a constraint even. We might recall Stravinsky's comments about how he felt the greatest freedom as a composer when he had set the greatest constraints on himself. It may seem paradoxical, but I think a little reflection shows that it might be a very true idea that somehow links into our psychology very, very carefully. At all events, this more practical view that composers needed to begin somewhere, they needed something to start with, is one that we shouldn't necessarily toss aside as too colorless to be considered. It still remains to say, though, which pieces do you choose? You can choose love songs that you wrote yourself, or ones written by your friends, or by someone that you've known, or someone you didn't know, but that you respect. On the program you'll hear tonight, you will hear mainly works in which Ochagem chose songs of his own composition as the basis for subsequent mass cycles. So taking a song that begins with the words "ma maîtresse," my mistress, and using it as the basis for two movements of a mass ordinary, which then came to be known by scribes and others as the "missa ma maîtresse," the mass based on my mistress. Sounds somehow very bawdy when you translate it. The last work on the program, to which Scott already alluded, the Missa de Plus en Plus. Again, it's a beginning of a song. In this case, though, not a song by Ochagem, but by Binchois. And as I mentioned, along with Dufailly, Binchois is the leading composer of the generation before Ochagem. I find the idea of him basing one of his masses on a song by Binchois especially appealing because, though we can't document it in any exact way, it would seem that Ochagem likely knew Binchois personally, perhaps even had him as a teacher, but certainly if they weren't closely associated, he had deep respect for him. When Binchois died in 1460, at a time when Ochagem was probably middle-aged, about 40, he wrote a ballade setting that is a setting of a French poem lamenting the death of Binchois explicitly and setting it against a plain chant from the Mass for the Dead. It's an act of homage and a rather beautiful one. Beyond that, there's another little song, and this is a more of a private kind of homage. There's a song by Ochagem that has a passage in the middle that when you hear it, if you're familiar with the songs of Binchois, you think, that sounds very familiar. And indeed it is. It is a passage lifted almost verbatim from a song that Binchois had written decades earlier, the original words of which were, "My heart cannot forget you." It is a private and very beautiful way of one composer paying homage to another. The movement that you will hear tonight from the Misa de Plus en Plus, this Ochagem Mass based on a song by Bachois, is, well, for my money, possibly the most beautiful movement Ochagem ever wrote. I promise you, I did not strong-arm Scott into programming it. I might have encouraged him. I certainly would not object when I saw it. I don't know quite how to explain exactly in such a short time what is so special about this movement, except to say that in this piece, perhaps to some greater degree than in even some of Ochagem's many, many wonderful works, we get this particular combination of effects that I associate with late 15th century music. A sense of focused concentration that is manifested in music in time that does not move so regularly that you feel a very, very constant pulse, but also not so vaguely that you have no sense of pulse at all. Rather, what I would encourage you to do as you listen to these movements, and that one perhaps in particular, but all of these mass movements that you're going to hear tonight, is to try and sense the shifting pulse that's underneath it. There's not a strong percussion section marking out these things, so one has to pay close attention. But I do think if you open yourself up to it, what you feel are these large pulses that sometimes seem to come in groups of two, sometimes in groups of three, sometimes harder to determine. They have a way of keeping the music buoyant. Any musician will tell you, one of the hardest things to escape in a performance of music is gravity, strangely enough. And I don't mean seriousness, I mean the actual gravity. Beats want to pull you down, always. And sometimes that's wonderful. But the illusion, and sadly for us it can only be an illusion, of being actually able to float off. I hope all of us have at some point had that experience listening to music. It is certainly what many performers aspire to. Listening to some of Ochagem's music, you feel that he aspired to it as well as a composer. With that, I'll leave you. I hope you enjoy the concert. Good night.